Right. Well, again, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. If you're just joining us, we're hopefully today going to finish the book of Daniel. I don't see why we shouldn't. There's only about one chapter and a few verses to go, so there should be plenty of time to take it fairly slowly. And let's pick up in Daniel chapter 11, where we left off last week. And Daniel 11, you may recollect, is the longest prophecy in the Bible. At least Mr. Armstrong said so. And as I said last week, Mr. Armstrong has done a pretty thorough job of documenting almost verse by verse by verse the entirety of Daniel 11. Daniel 11 is in many places already fulfilled, right down to where we got to last week, which was verses 31 and 32. And there wasn't much more I could add to those verses, and Mr. Armstrong has already covered. So my recommendation to you, if you're interested in understanding Daniel 11, is obtain Mr. Armstrong's booklet, The Middle East in Prophecy, and it will take you through Daniel 11 in considerable detail. And we'll pick up the story now. Let's just go over verses, verse 31, I think, and then we'll move on. Verse 31 is talking of the fulfillment way back in the days of this gentleman called Antiochus Epiphanes, who's described as a vile man, a little horn earlier in the book of Daniel, and an individual that caused great destruction in Jerusalem. He brought this pagan statue of Jupiter Olympus into the sanctuary. He killed many of the priests. He slew pigs and swine on the altar. He really desecrated the holy temple and caused a great deal of destruction around Jerusalem. So quite an evil and wicked individual, but no more than a type of somebody similar to come in our day. And that's where we're, verse 31. It talks of forces or armies shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there in the sanctuary the abomination of desolation. And it is in fact historically recorded that Antiochus Epiphanes, who called himself a God manifest in the flesh, did actually stop the sacrifices. Those were the 2 days, morning and evening. Sacrifices were offered day by day by day by day, sometimes referred to as the continual, and Antiochus stopped them for approximately 3 years and put this particular pagan statue in there instead. And of course some people do believe the same statue is to be found today in the Vatican, which I've never been able to prove that, but that's been said on a number of occasions. So moving on then to verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he, Antiochus, shall corrupt with flattery. And it does seem that he did manage to induce or seduce a number of the Jews to go against their Jewish covenant, if you like, and line up with him. What we then seem to get in verse 32 is one of these time gaps. It seems the story jumps at this point from Antiochus round about 168 BC and comes right up to the time of Jesus and the apostles, because it says, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And really, to be fair, the Jews never really knew their God. By this time, by 160 odd BC, they had been pretty much corrupted by Greek mythology and Greek ideas. And so this appears now to be talking of or updating us as to the time of the apostles. The people who know their God would be the apostles, those called of God, the New Testament brethren, you know, our forefathers and foremothers and whatever, way back around about 30, 40 or so AD. These were the people who knew their God, and these were people who carried out great exploits. Verse 33, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many. And of course, if you read through the book of Acts, we find deacons and the deaconesses and the apostles and evangelists and people spreading the word of God all around the Middle East and eventually into Europe and so on. Yet for many days carrying on, they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. And of course, I guess that's a summary really of way back then to almost up to now, because you know, certainly the Catholic Church and various other governments over the centuries took plenty of pleasure in trying to track down Sabbath keepers and God's people, and very often they were slain by the sword and of course burned at the stake. That's been pretty much existed with God's people since the very beginning. Verse 34, "Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue." And my margin says, by slipperiness or flattery. And it's regrettable, but predicted, that God's church has not always been pure. It has been infiltrated many times by false brethren and equally by false ministers. And there's nothing quite as bad in some ways as a false minister, because ministers, by their sort of position, if you want to use that term, can influence their congregation, their congregations. I was just thinking this week, my wife was talking to me about one congregation in England where virtually every single person, barring I think possibly one couple, has stayed in Worldwide Church of God. Now if you look back to the 80s and the 90s, probably in most cities or towns, I would imagine, it's just my imagination here, that probably large numbers would have left Worldwide and gone to Living or gone to United or gone to PCG or gone to whatever. And perhaps only a remnant, perhaps 50%, perhaps a bit less, perhaps a fraction more, might have stayed with Worldwide Church of God. But there's one congregation in England where almost to a man and woman, the entirety have stayed Worldwide Church of God. I'm just thinking, why would that be the case? Why would they have not lost perhaps a third or a quarter or half their members to other groups who are endeavouring to hold on to the truth? I guess the answer is that it's down to the minister. In large part, I guess over the years, he has seduced them. He has watered down the truth. He has lulled them into a sense of false security. And when the time came to stand up for the truth, they were too weak, and they've now become very cozy and comfortable with the false doctrines of Worldwide Church of God. So it's certainly the case that a minister can be very, very destructive. And equally, of course, brethren have a responsibility to test and to be alert. But equally, of course, the minister was in St. James, "Be not many teachers, my brethren, knowing that we shall receive a greater judgment." Because a teacher, a minister, can influence for the good, but equally for the bad, potentially, many, many people. Verse 35, we were at, "Some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purge them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time." And so that really encapsulates the history of God's church. Intrigue, flattery, slippery brethren, slippery ministers, persecution off and on right down through the years. But equally, those who are wise, who have understanding, have been able to teach others. Verse 36, "Then," and this I guess must be somewhere in the between 30-odd AD and later, "then the king," talking of the king of the north at this point, "shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done." And the king of the north at this point, following the apostles and so on, is Rome. Rome had swallowed up the earlier kings of the north, and this is now talking of the Roman Empire. And yes, the Roman Empire and its emperors certainly did exalt themselves above every god. It was the norm for the Roman emperors to be worshipped. they were that important in their own eyes. Verse 37, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God or gods, for he shall magnify himself above them all. And yes, indeed, you know, the Roman emperors were actually sacrificed too. Many of the citizens of Rome were actually quite happy to recognize the emperor as a god. After all, you know, he had the power of life and death, pretty much. He could ensure that your country was protected or raised to the ground in warfare. He had that power. And so for many, many centuries, the Roman emperors were deified, worshipped as gods. And of course, that was certainly very different from earlier generations. It says here in verse 37, he, the king of the north, shall regard neither the god of his fathers nor the desire of women, meaning apparently the god that women desire, which Dr. Herman Hay used to say was Tammuz, according to my inspired marginal note. Tammuz was I think one of the early versions of a Cupid or a Valentine. And so the ladies, it appears, in ancient times, used to long for, desire, and of course weep at times for Tammuz or Cupid or Valentine. But this particular individual, nope, none of that. He magnifies himself above them all. Verse 38, but in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses or munitions or armed force. And certainly that's pretty much fits the Roman Empire. A very powerful empire, ruthless, excellent at warfare, and for many centuries was able to destroy anybody that stood in its path, until of course they finally rotted from within. And a god which his fathers did not know he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. And somewhere in here it does seem to move into the Holy Roman Empire, because the original Roman Empire was pagan. And but later on, of course, the papacy came along, gained considerable influence, and you now had no longer open paganism. It was now a version of Christianity, but as we know, false Christianity. It talked about Christ, it talked about God, it talked about the Lord's Supper and communion and things of that nature. It sort of accepted the scriptures. And so the Roman Empire changed from being a downright open pagan to being a concealed pagan, mystery pagan, but calling itself Christianity, and allegedly worshipping a new god, the God of the Old Testament. Verse 39, thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge, and advance its glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. And really, if you look through the history of Europe, through the Middle Ages and so on, the Catholic Church and the numerous resurrections of the so-called Holy Roman Empire, they did divide Europe for gain. And much of it really was about power, prestige, and money. And the popes were very often quite a corrupt and a dishonest lot, and they very often, you know, sold and purchased favors with kings and emperors down through the centuries. So that, up to verse 39, seems to bring us, you know, broadly right through the Middle Ages up to, as verse 40 says, the time of the end. And of course at this point, in a sense, it becomes harder to understand many of these prophecies. As we said before, if you're looking back at fulfillment, it's not that hard. I'm not saying we're perfect at fitting in historic events. I'm sure Daniel 11 and the verse we've read so far, Mr. Armstrong says, well, you know, this is identified with that particular event in history, and probably some people would argue over one or two of those. But on the whole, if you're looking at fulfilled prophecy, you can pretty much nail it down, more or less. However, when you come to yet to be fulfilled prophecy, then it's very different. At this point, you have to admit, I think, if you're going to be honest, that you're getting into the area of some speculation, because it does seem that prophecy is rather tricky ahead of time to be clear about. You can sort of see, I think, an outline. You can see through a glass darkly, but at least from my perspective, much of it remains a little bit clouded. And I guess that's the way God wants it. As things do come to pass, and we see them in the newspapers and on the TV reports or with our own eyeballs, we'll be hopefully able to say, oh, hang on a second, I think I'm just spotting a fulfillment of Daniel or Habakkuk or Isaiah or whatever. But ahead of time, it's more difficult. And so from this part, Daniel 11:40, right through to the end of the book, we are looking at yet to be fulfilled prophecies, and I think we better just take it as being, as I say, an outline. We can read the words, we can hopefully remember the descriptions and the illustrations, but their actual fulfillment, I wouldn't like to be too dogmatic. There's room to wriggle here. So verse 40, at the time of the end, well, that seems to pretty much be relating to our days today. At the time of the end, the king of the south, must obviously still exist, shall attack him, that is the king of the north. And the king of the north shall come against him, shall retaliate, like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries that overwhelm them and pass through. So here's talking of really quite a major event at the time of the end. Now, Mr. Armstrong did think this probably had already taken place. He read this as being possibly Ethiopia, being identified by him as the king of the south, perhaps pushing at or attacking Italy, which would be perhaps the king of the north. And Italy came back against Ethiopia around about the 1930s and so on. Well, possibly, but it does seem with the passage of time that perhaps if that was the case, it was no more than just another little type. And I think most people nowadays would say that probably verse 40 is yet to be totally fulfilled. And we are now looking at an event yet to happen. And somewhere in our day, in the next X number of years, the king of the south, question mark, who would that be, will push at the king of the north. Now the king of the north we probably all fairly happily accept is going to be some sort of a European combination of nations, a United Nations of Europe, possibly, led by Germany. And the king of the south, whoever that might be, is going to attack him or push at him or provoke him in some way. And in retaliation, the king of the north, the European countries, are going to come against him, it says, like a whirlwind. It's a fast and furious with chariots and horsemen. Well, that's old-fashioned language, but today, let's, I guess, translate that as with tanks, with military men, with many ships, and I guess with the airplanes. He shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So the king of the north will be victorious at this time. Europe will be victorious over the king of the south. Now, as to who the king of the south might be, well, I guess your idea is as good as mine, basically. Mr. Armstrong thought initially it was Ethiopia, but I think he felt latterly that, well, that was historic, and perhaps somebody else subsequent to that, in that general region. Mr. Gerald Fleury, of course, has been fairly adamant that the king of the south is Iran, modern-day Persia. And if you look at Iran today, you'd certainly say it sort of fits the bill, apart from one little minor point. You think, well, hang on a second, Iran is a very, very strong nation. It's got a massive military, it's got submarines, it's got aircraft, it's got missiles, it possibly has got some nuclear weapons, it's certainly trying to develop others, and it's a very powerful, dogmatic nation that says that there was no Holocaust, that the Jews should be driven into the sea, and has got no love at all for America. And its president, Mr. Ahmadinejad, as he's often referred to, is a man who believes that he is leading the way to the coming Islamic Messiah, the Mahdi. So you think, well, hang on. Of all the countries you can think of, the most powerful, dogmatic, provocative nation today, surely the one that is behind so much of today's terrorism is Iran. So therefore, is Iran indeed the king of the south? It sort of fits most of the time, apart from the fact that it isn't actually south of Jerusalem. And you'd rather imagine the king of the south would come from the south. If you look in the map, you'll find that Iran is actually east of Jerusalem, and in fact Tehran is probably somewhat northeast of Jerusalem. So possibly, but possibly not. If not, I guess you might find that Iran links with other countries from somewhere further south, some of the countries of North Africa. So that remains a little bit unclear, but I guess what you could say is almost certainly is going to be an Islamic combine of nations, because quite clear, I think, to most of us that Islam and the Muslim people don't have much time, by and large, for Christianity and the West. This would appear to be some type of Islamic regime, possibly using its oil wealth to push at and to provoke Europe. And they'll do that, and the Europeans will not take it lying down. They will retaliate, and they will invade, and they'll be victorious over the king of the south, which one imagines will be these Islamic countries. Verse 41, the king of the north shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. So he invades, or occupies, or liberates, depending on your language, Palestine and modern day Israel. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. So these countries of what we would class as modern day Jordan do seem to escape. He doesn't invade those, and that's one of the reasons that we have speculated that perhaps because Petra is in that region, maybe that's why they've been left out of the invasion. Because after all, if the place of safety was in Petra, many question marks against that, then it wouldn't be a surprise that Edom, Moab would be left out of this invasion. A lot of question marks there. Verse 42, he, the king of the north, shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So it's pretty obvious that Egypt is allied to the king of the south, because the invasion comes down, swooping down south, occupies, liberates, whatever, Palestine, and Egypt is occupied along with many other countries. Verse 43, he, the king of the north, shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And of course there's plenty of oil in that part of the world, and oil equals wealth and economic health. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Ethiopians is actually Cushites in the Hebrew, so you're talking of black Africans, and they also will be following at his heels like little dogs. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. So after he's occupied these lands, and perhaps a number of months, or maybe a year, or a bit longer has passed, there'll be problems from the northeast, east and north. Well, it tells in the next verse that by that stage, well, read it, verse 45, he, the king of the north, shall plant the tents of his palace, the New American Standard Bible says, the tents of his royal pavilion, between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. So it suggests that the king of the north is going to at some point move his headquarters to Jerusalem. And of course, from Jerusalem, what is east and north? So verse 44 says, news from the east and the north shall trouble him. You know, he's occupied the Middle East, perhaps got access finally to the gold, the silver, the diamonds, the oil, perhaps feeling fairly secure at this stage. Moves his headquarters to Jerusalem, but suddenly news of perhaps imminent invasion from the north and the east troubles him, and therefore he goes out with, it says, great fury to destroy and annihilate many. So he's off again at war, and of course east and north of Jerusalem, where he now has his headquarters, is Russia and China. So you're talking really of the Russian, the Slavic, and the Oriental nations appear to be lining up to perhaps get their share of the Middle East wealth. And rather than waiting for that to happen, the king of the north starts another invasion, another attack. Verse 45, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and no one will help him. Because the king of the north, we would also, I guess, call the beast. This would be the beast empire, and it's only a suggestion or more speculation. We sort of believe it's probably going to be led by Germany, and the political military leader may well be a German. He will be in close relationship with a false prophet, which we always take to be probably the Pope and the Vatican. So they'll work hand in hand, hand in glove, to dominate the Middle East, Europe, and so on. But of course, they'll both come to their end. And at that stage, when Jesus intervenes, there's no further rescue from them. So that becomes a bit more speculative as we get to these last few verses of Daniel 11. And what we do seem to see is a king of the south, yet to be fully identified. Maybe Iran, but geographically it does seem to be in the wrong place. But certainly, I say certainly, I think almost surely, some sort of Islamic, Muslim, dominated empire or combination of countries will provoke, push at Europe, already doing it in many ways, and that will bring about a counter-offensive, and the King of the North, Europe, will occupy, dominate the Middle East, get access to the wealth, move the headquarters there, and then something will provoke a massive counter-invasion against Russia and its Oriental allies. That seemed to be broadly the picture there, but details no doubt to follow. And I may be a bit wrong, but there we go. Daniel chapter 12, and starting in verse 1. At that time, so we're talking of the time of the end, and that's yet future, that's for sure. At that time, Michael, who is an archangel, shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. So that tells us something, doesn't it? We're talking of days unequaled and paralleled in all history. There shall be a time of trouble. Let's call that a time of great tribulation, shall we? Because that's what it is. There'll be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And if you look back in history, there have been some pretty bad times. The Second World War was a bad time. The Holocaust, with the 6 million Jews and the Gypsies and other peoples exterminated by people that like listening to Wagner and like looking at works of art. And that was only 50, 60 years ago. It's really just a blink in time. And that was pretty bad. And of course, the Stalin, they reckon, probably disposed of something like 20 million of his own people. You're talking of times of great destruction and a horror in some of our living memories. But it talks here of a time of trouble unlike anything previous. So that tells us something, doesn't it? It's going to be a pretty bad time ahead. And of course, there are other parallel passages. If we turn to, hold your place there, let's turn to Matthew 24. And that does help us identify, of course, certain scriptures as being parallel, because you can only have one time that's the worst ever, Matthew 24. And we'll pick up in verse 21. Matthew 24, verse 21. For then, this is at the end time, there will be great tribulation, great affliction, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. So that's a parallel to Daniel 12:1, when Michael stands up for our peoples. It says a time of unparalleled trouble, It says here, great tribulation, unlike anything before, in verse 22, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be cut short. And you've got to think, you know, how bad can it get? It says, unless those days are cut short, you know, by God's intervention, no flesh would be saved. And some translations say no flesh would be saved alive. Now, it's hard to imagine that. The world today, I think, is something like about 6.5 billion people spread over, you know, five continents. How could you bring about a situation where there was no flesh alive anywhere? But Jesus has read letters. Jesus said that's going to happen. He said there's going to be such great tribulation, such horrific affliction, unlike anything ever before. And unless, you know, my Father and I cut those days short, there'd be no life left alive anywhere. So that's talking of a pretty grim time, is it not? And we can see the context back at verse 15 there. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whosoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and so on. So this is all at a time when an abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel is around. When we see that abomination of desolation, which Daniel refers to, and that's going to be covered later in Daniel 12, then at that time we know that the days are going to be such as, unless they are cut short, it's the end of human existence, not as we know it, but just full stop. No more human beings on the earth, all gone. The whole world in blackness and darkness because of man's, you know, stupidity and foolishness and the impact of Satan and his demons on man's mentality. And all that happens at a time that when you see the abomination of desolation in Jerusalem. So that's another clear reference to a time unparalleled in man's history. And one more, Jeremiah 30. If we flip back to Jeremiah chapter 30. Jeremiah chapter 30, which is the whole chapter is about the latter days. I think it says that somewhere. If you look at chapter 30 in the last verse, verse 24, just the last part of it, it says that in the latter days you'll consider it. Or one translation says, understand it thoroughly in the latter days. So Jeremiah 30 is all about the latter days, and that's what, of course, from Michael arises at, in the latter days. But verse 3 of chapter 30, for behold, and this is God speaking, for behold, the days are coming, says Eternal, that I will bring back from captivity my people Israel and Judah. Bring them back from captivity. And you can't come back from it, of course, unless you are in it. And I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it. So God says the days are coming when I will bring them back from captivity. And it says, in the latter days you shall thoroughly understand this. But dropping down to verse 5, for thus says the Eternal, we have heard a voice of trembling or of fear, not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with child. Is that the case? So why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor, and all faces turn pale? Why such anguish out there among people? Alas, verse 7, for that day is great so that none is like it. It's unparalleled. It's a one-off. It's the worst ever. It says that day is great so that none, no other day is like it. It is a time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. But unfortunately, only after he's been in it. So the time of Jacob's trouble, unparalleled time, no other day like it. And that's what we're reading of back in Daniel. So maybe we'll turn back there. Daniel 12. And verse 1 we just read, that it's a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation to that day. And that's paralleled by Matthew 24, the Great Tribulation, and the time of Jacob's trouble. Jacob, of course, being modern day America, Britain, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the modern Israelite nations. a time of trouble unlike any they've seen before. And except these days are cut short, no flesh will be saved alive. Carrying on in verse 1 of chapter 12. At that time, when all this great trouble is, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And I think we've taken that to be delivered physically, those who are written in the book, being probably the book of remembrance. So I guess if we turn to Malachi chapter 3, we can see that. In Malachi chapter 3, again, this is not, let's say, 100% clear and guaranteed, because it's future prophecy, but it's talking here about your people being delivered, those who are written in a book, not necessarily the book of life, but verse 16 of Malachi chapter 3, talking of, a little heading in mine ear says, the rewards of the book of remembrance, is the little heading that the translators have stuck in. But verse 16, then, at some future time, those who feared the Eternal spoke to one another, and the Eternal listened and heard them. So a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Eternal and to meditate on his name or esteem his name. So here is not the book of life, apparently, but a book of remembrance. And certain names go into this book of remembrance. The names are those who fear the Eternal, who respect God, who talk often to one another, who are interested in God's ways, who esteem his name. And a book is written, a book of remembrance, and the names go in. I suppose the question is your name in? Is my name in there, or is there a blank space waiting? Verse 17, they shall be mine, says the Eternal of hosts, on the day that I make them my special jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. Oh, so God says he's going to spare these people. Will spare them from what? Well, by the sound of it, if we're looking at Daniel, from the end time tribulation and troubles. And do we know of other places in Scripture that talk about God's people being spared and delivered, protected, or a place of safety? To which answer is yes, we do know of such places. Verse 18, and then you shall again discern between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and one who does not serve him. So those that are righteous and who serve God will become God's special jewels, special treasure, and will be spared. And they'll have their names written in this book of remembrance. And those who are not righteous and who are wicked won't. So back to chapter 12 and verse 1. It says, at that time your people shall be delivered physically, I believe, everyone who is found written in the book. And so Mr. Flory always felt, and I tend to agree with him, that's the book of remembrance. Verse 2, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And of course, talking there of, well, there's two resurrections there. One is a resurrection to everlasting life, and of course, the wicked, it will be a resurrection to the lake of fire. Shame, it says, and everlasting contempt. Everlasting abhorrence, my margin says. Verse 3, those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And I guess we'd like to think that we're the wise, because those who are wise, it says, shall shine like the brightness of the sky, and those who turn many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. And these are rewards that await those who are faithful, who are found living God's way, who esteem the Father's name, who are wise. And who's a wise person? Well, of course, a wise person is a person that figures out pretty early in life that God's ways are better, and then happily pursues them. But those who are wise, it said, shall shine like the brightness of the brilliant sky and like the stars forever and ever. And we can see a reference to that if we turn to Matthew 13. Matthew chapter 13. cutting into one of many of Jesus' parables in Matthew 13, but picking up just briefly in verse 43. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. The wise will hear, and the foolish won't. But in those days, the righteous will shine forth as the sun. And we know that. We know many scriptures that talk about how our bodies will be changed. We'll receive a glorified spirit body with, it will shine and radiate because we'll be immortal, have eternal life, unlike this temporary physical chemical existence of today. But we've got to be wise. We've got to heed. We've got to be alert. So back to Daniel chapter 12. So this is, by the way, still the angel Gabriel still explaining all this to Daniel. It started way back, chapter 10-ish. And this is all just Gabriel explaining information bit by bit by bit to Daniel. But verse 4, "But you, Daniel," says the angel, "shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end." So that's why, in a sense, you and I are studying it, because these are the days at the time of the end, as far as we can make out. Certainly, we're in our end time, that's for sure. And the book is sealed until the time of the end. "Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." And does that not apply to today? Are there not many running to and fro today? Is knowledge not increasing exponentially today? There's so much information out there. The internet in particular makes it possible to, you'd just be swamped. You're going to find information about almost anything. Just tap in 2-3 words on Google and you'll find there's about 95 billion sites you can look at. You could live to be 2 million years old. You'd still be reading them. Knowledge today has increased dramatically. And many do run to and fro. I think, as we said a few weeks back, apparently in Jewish literature today and newspapers and so on, the expression "to surf the internet" is the same Hebrew expression as is here translated "run to and fro," because essentially that's what you're doing when you surf the internet. You just run from one site to another, backwards and forwards, here and there, follow this link, then that link. So you could almost translate this that many shall surf the internet and knowledge shall increase. That's a bit of a rough and ready translation, of course, but it sort of fits. These days, at the time of the end, there are days when knowledge has totally exploded and many are running all over the place pursuing knowledge, and even physically. There are so many millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions a year traveling backwards and forwards across the globe. It's incredible. Anyway, verse 5. So that's the end of the message there. Verse 5. "Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two other angels, I imagine, one on this river bank and the other on that river bank. And one said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be?" How long is it going to take for this to all happen? "Then I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished." And what does that mean? Well, verse 8, "Although I heard, I did not understand." So Daniel said, well, hang on, that tells me nothing. "Then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" And it wasn't for Daniel to know. He said, "Daniel, go your way. Just, Daniel, don't worry about it. Just carry on, get back doing your own things, Daniel. Don't sweat it. For the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end." In other words, even though Daniel was given this prophecy, it wasn't for Daniel. It's quite plain, isn't it? "Daniel, don't bother. Don't worry. Don't be anxious. Don't ask any more questions, Daniel. The words are closed up. They are sealed. They're not for you. They're closed up and sealed till a particular time, and that is the time of the end. And at that time, the words will be opened and unsealed, So in some ways, you know, quite curious. So here is Daniel, a man greatly beloved, been shown amazing things, given great information, and in fact, it wasn't for him. But nonetheless, he wrote it down for the time of the end. And here are you and I at the time of the end. And I don't think for a moment that all things have yet been completely revealed. We still, like I said, numerous times, hopefully throughout this entire series, we see through a glass darkly. We have some understanding here and there, but not complete. And we have to be open to further revelation as it comes along, as long as it, you know, fits the scriptures. So Daniel was told, Daniel, don't worry about it. It's not for you to know, it's for a time way down the road, round the corner, far off in the future. Just go your way, Daniel, don't worry about it. Back at verse 7 then, the angel says it will be for time, times, and half a time. And we've taken that, I think, with good sense to be 3.5 years. Time is a year, times is 2 years, and half a time is half a year, so that comes to a grand total of 3.5 years. And when the power of the holy people, would that be the saints, that the church of God has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. The New American Standard Bible says all these events will be completed. You know, once the power of the holy people has been totally shattered, then all these events will be completed. The Darby says all these things shall be finished. And it takes time, times, and half a time. 3.5 years. Do we find that period of time referred to anywhere else? Yes, we do. We hold our place there and turn to Revelation chapter 12. There are these periods of time given, obviously, for a reason. And even though they're not totally clear to us today, they will become clear at some point. So we should know what they say and where we find them. And then hopefully as understanding develops, then we will say, yep, the jigsaw is now falling into place. It now makes far more sense. I now see exactly what the scriptures had there all these centuries. Verse 14 of chapter 12, very well known passage, somewhat enigmatic of course itself, but the woman, talking of the church of God, was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So here at the end time it talks of the church of God being given an opportunity to fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished, looked after, catered for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So there was those time, times, and half a time again. But of course, it seems that not everybody is there who ought to be there, because it says, verse 17, the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So even though the woman is in her place and is being nourished and protected for time, times, and half a time, the dragon is filled with rage and anger that he can't reach this woman, and he turns around and makes war. I think that means makes war, violent, murderous, deathly, against the rest of her offspring. And notice that her offspring keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So for some reason, there's a certain number of the women who are not in this place. And Satan is enraged and goes against them to make war, to destroy and to kill, for presumably the same time and times and half a time that the woman is being protected. So it looks like war ensues on the rest of her offspring for time, times, and half a time. We find that scripture. Yep, all the way back to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 25, talking of the fourth beast, and the little horn that speaks pompous words, you might recollect, verse 25. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So those would appear to be the Revelation 12:17 saints. They are under the power of the little horn and the Vatican, the papacy, the Catholic Church for time and times and half a time. Satan clearly working through the Pope and the Catholic Church to make war and to destroy. And that will be applicable, no doubt, not just to God's people, but also to Israel as a whole, people of Israel as a whole. So back to Daniel 12. And in that process of time, it says that the power of God's people will be completely shattered, totally shattered. Where we get to verse 9 was, "Oh yeah, go your way, Daniel. It's not for you. The words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified," or purify themselves, "made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." And so certainly those of us who are wise will understand, and those of us who are wicked will not. It does appear to be speaking of the saints, basically. So hopefully you and I should recognize that it's important that we do purify ourselves, that we do live right, that we are serious about walking with God in these end times, because there are some dramatic events ahead of us. We know that. Jesus said, "Except those days are cut short, no flesh will be saved alive." We're not talking about just being cozy in church and warming a pew. We're talking about events to take place on planet Earth that are so horrendous, so awful, that there's been no time like them ever up till now. And it makes sense that you and I recognize the seriousness of the days we live in. And it says here, "Many shall be purified," or "shall purify themselves." And who can do that but you? In a sense, it's up to you and I whether we decide to make, you know, God at number one in our lives. Like the first commandment says, "I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other gods before me." Well, can you say honestly that applies in your life? Jesus said, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness." Well, it's an easy one to answer. Do you? Do I? Or does God come sort of, you know, third, or maybe seventh, or maybe 22nd in our lives? Because if he's anywhere other than first, then we're not purified. If God is anywhere other than first, we're in trouble, because God won't play second fiddle. Where we get to verse 11, here's some more days that come in, and we can speculate a wee bit here. We have to, because we don't know for sure. But verse 11, "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation," remember Jesus spoke of that, "is set up, there shall be 1290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1335 days. Interesting. "But you, Daniel, go your way till the end, for you shall rest," you'll be dead in other words, "and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days." So Daniel's told, "Daniel, don't worry about it. Go your way. You will rest. Yeah, you will fall asleep in death, and you'll lie there in the grave, so to speak, quietly as the centuries pass you by. But then, Daniel, because you're a man beloved and he was purified, you will arise to your inheritance, eternal life and a great reward at the end of the days." And it sort of implies here that at the end of these days, the 1290 and the 1335 days is the time when Daniel will be resurrected. And so the resurrection, this is what the church has believed in the past, Mr. Armstrong included, believe that these days terminate at the resurrection. So there is 1290 days, and there's 1335 days, and there's also the time times and half a time, which we believe is 3.5 years, which comes to 1,260 days. And so you've got 1,335, 1,290, 1,260, but what on earth do they mean? And of course we'd all like to know. So we can speculate, and Mr. Armstrong did some of that, and the Church of God historically did do that, and it's not the only version you can come across. There's a few other versions out there as to what these days signify. Some are extremely weird, and some, you know, plausible-ish. But for the time being, we'll just stick with what Mr. Armstrong taught on this subject, and if it's right or wrong, we'll find out in due season. And the understanding here is that the 1335 days starts 1335 days before the resurrection, the 1290 before the resurrection, and the 1260 before the resurrection. Okay, so 1335, and then 45 days elapses and you get to 1290, then 30 days elapses and you get to 1260, and then all those days elapse and you get to the resurrection. That's sort of the timing of what takes place on those days. You know, what's the sort of signification of them? Well, certainly verse 11 looks relatively clear, but is open to some dispute, I've got to say. Verse 11, from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, okay, well, that tells us something. The daily sacrifice has to be taken away. And of course, you can't take it away unless it's already started. Taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1290 days. So it looks like 1290 days before Jesus returns, the daily sacrifice, which will have been running for some time, will be taken away, and presumably at the same time, but not absolutely guaranteed, the abomination of desolation will be set up, 1290 days before Christ's return. So what is the abomination of desolation? Will there be daily sacrifices? There's no temple, is there, today? Will there be a temple built? Well, Mr. Armstrong said, I'm quoting now from an article he wrote in the January 1980 Good News, talking of verse 11, he says, this does not imply a material temple to be built in our time in Jerusalem. Now, that's not Mr. Armstrong saying it will never happen. He says this doesn't imply necessarily that there'll be a temple in Jerusalem. It's possible, but you don't need one. He carries on, it does seem to imply the Israelis may restore their daily sacrifice, possibly at the Wailing Wall. He was speculating there. So what he's saying is that, well, yep, this verse in Daniel 12:11 pretty much tells us that there will be a restored daily sacrifice in Jerusalem, which will be actually stopped. It will cease 1290 days before Jesus returns, and an abomination of desolation will be set up at that time. Will it happen that way? Well, we'll have to wait and see. Let's turn to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. Because Mr. Armstrong also said that the abomination of desolation was armies surrounding Jerusalem, not necessarily a pagan statue of some sort. Luke 21, and starting in verse 20. Verse 20, Luke 21, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. One translation says, when you see Jerusalem being encircled by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Mr. Armstrong said it's armies that desolate Jerusalem, not just a, you know, stone or metal statue sitting in a room somewhere. So again, that's Mr. Armstrong's sort of final sort of view on that, that it will be the armies which will encircle Jerusalem 1290 days before Christ's return. So that would be something to look for. When you see Jerusalem being encircled by armies, then know its desolation is near. That is the abomination of desolation being established, being set up. His desolation is then near, but it doesn't actually happen at the 1290 days It happens 30 days later at 1260. But carrying on in verse 21, then, when you see this, these armies encircling Jerusalem, and you know his desolation is, oops, a matter of days away, then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. And that would include all things written in the book of Daniel. So it does look like at 1290 days before Christ's return, armies will encircle Jerusalem, and then there's a brief period of time to escape. It says, then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. If you're in the countryside roundabout, don't go into Jerusalem. Keep well away, because these are the days of vengeance. Dangerous days. Keep well away. We turn to Revelation chapter 11. We can see the 1260 days mentioned. So 30 days elapses, in other words, after the armies encircle Jerusalem. 30 days of time to escape, by the sound of it. And Revelation chapter 11, we just read there that Jerusalem will be under vengeance for a time. Verse 2 of chapter 11, leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. So Jerusalem will be trodden underfoot, apparently the days of vengeance, for 42 months, which equals, one count at least, 1260 days. Verse 3, whilst we're here, I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1260 days, clothed in sackcloth. So it looks like for 1260 days, Jerusalem will be trodden underfoot, and the two witnesses will prophesy, and that will bring us up to very close to Christ's return. Okay, so back to Daniel chapter 12. We've got a possible marker for the 1290 days. It says the sacrifice will be stopped, the abomination of desolation set up. So you've got potentially here, the sacrifices have been running for a little while. How long? Question mark. And in come these European armies, and they stop the sacrifice, and they encircle Jerusalem. That's 1290 days. And then it looks like 30 days later at 1260, the tribulation starts, and Jerusalem is pounded, thumped, and trodden underfoot for 1260 days. But verse 12, blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1335 days, which would appear to be 45 days prior to the armies encircling Jerusalem. If we're working backwards from Christ's return, you get to 1260, further back 1290, further back 1335. What happens at 1335? Well, again, anybody's guess. Mr. Armstrong always thought, I believe, that that would be the time when the organized work of the Church of God would finish. So the Church would be working furiously, printing plain truths on radio, TV, right up to 30 and 35 days. Work would stop at 45 days to get packed and so on. And then you see the armies encircling Jerusalem, and 30 more days to get to the place of safety. That's broadly, I think, how we saw it. But of course, really, the passage of time, that doesn't look very plausible any longer, because to say the organized work stops then would suggest that there is an organized work to stop. And really, without being unkind, when you look around the churches of God today, there's not a great deal really happening, is there? If you compare Mr. Armstrong in 1985, let's say, with 400 TV stations, with 7 or 8 million plain truths a month, with his regular meetings with presidents, prime ministers, kings, and so on, and then you add up together today everything that's being done by Restored or PCG or Living or United, even the best of intentions, it's not much of an organized work, is it? So that seems to be perhaps not quite right. The other possibility is that, well, hang on, if the sacrifices are being stopped at 1290 days, they have to start, don't they? So maybe the warning is that at 1335 days, the Jews start their daily sacrifices somewhere in Jerusalem in the temple area, because that would certainly be a pretty clear indication to those who are watching that, the Jews have started. Now, does this mean that 45 days' time, the Roman Empire's army is going to stop them? And I guess that is a possibility. There's a possibility. Of course, what would start the sacrifices? Well, the Jews have wanted to begin sacrificing for decades now. There are currently today in Jerusalem individuals who are identified as being of the lineage of a Levi. There are individuals who've been trained in using temple utensils. They have been looking for a red heifer for some time, whose ashes they can use to purify. The one thing that's missing at the moment is, of course, the Ark of the Covenant. Some people speculate that the Ark of the Covenant has been found and is shortly to be revealed to the waiting world. And if that does happen, I guess that will be a great incentive to the Jews to start their sacrifices. So it's a question mark, but maybe the 1335 is that final signal that the rundown has begun. Maybe that's when the sacrifices start. 45 days later, of course, having offended, no doubt, most of Christianity, and particularly the Catholic world, they'll be summarily stopped. Verse 12 says, "Blessed is he who waits, talking of, I think, you and I, blessed is the church member who waits patiently, is implied, and comes eventually to the 1,335 days. The New American Standard Bible says, "How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. An impression there that many are going to fall away, but the ones who keep on going, who wait patiently, who don't give up, and reach this particular milestone, they're blessed, because from then on, I wouldn't say it's a doddle, but from then on, it's things have got a sort of life of their own. If you turn to Revelation chapter 3, once you've got to that point, and you've seen it, and you're aware, I think you know that this is it. You know, we're in the running now. We definitely rounded the final straight. This is definitely the home straight. We're down. Revelation 3, we're talking of really waiting patiently till the 1335 days have arrived. Revelation 3 verse 10, it says, talking to those of a Philadelphian attitude, "Because you have kept my command to persevere," or literally, "the word of my patience," you've been patient, "I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth." So here's a promise to those who keep the word of Jesus' patience, who are patient, who continue, who don't fall away, who stay there, who endure to the end, "because you have kept the word of my patience." Jesus said, "I will keep you. I will keep you and preserve you from the hour of trial which will come upon the whole world." So that would be a blessing, wouldn't it? If you patiently wait till the 1335 days and are then preserved from the hour of trial, that's a pretty big blessing. Let's turn to Matthew 24:13. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 13. I guess a fairly well-known verse, but it's in the context of the end times. Matthew 24 is Matthew's version of the Olivet prophecy. It's just a verse or two before the abomination of desolation. Verse 13, "He who endures to the end shall be saved," or "he who waits patiently to the end time shall be saved or delivered or protected." So in context, rather than just necessarily talking of being, you know, of salvation eternally, we're talking here about he who endures, who sticks with it, who remains patient, right, will be preserved, will be delivered. And you and I know people who haven't, don't we? And you and I might not ourselves if we're not alert and alive to the possibility of falling asleep. But he who endures patiently, who waits patiently to the end, shall be saved. Or he who waits to the 30 and 35 days, perhaps, will be saved. Let's turn to Luke 21 again. Luke 21, where we just read about the armies surrounding Jerusalem, getting the abomination of desolation that desolates them. Luke 21. We just started at verse 20. Look at verse 19, which perhaps belongs with verse 20. Luke 21:19. In your patience or endurance, it says, possess your souls. And then verse 20, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know its desolation is near, and then flee, etc., etc. Verse 19, in your patience and your endurance, possess your souls. The Farrah Fenton version is, by your patience, you shall preserve your lives. So linking that with Daniel 12, he who waits patiently, he who endures until the 1335 days, that man or woman is blessed. Now that's a possibility. There may be other explanations, well, I know there are other ones because I've come across a few of them, but they're not altogether fully plausible. So the best understanding Mr. Armstrong had really was that at 1335 days something dramatic happens, he thought the work would end. It's perhaps more likely that the sacrifices will start. At 1290 days, the sacrifices the Jews will be carrying out will be stopped. The armies will encircle Jerusalem. And 30 days later, the 1260 days of the tribulation start, with the armies invading and trampling over Jerusalem and God's people and so on and so forth. So what does that mean for you and I? Well, as we've said a number of times, prophecy is rather tricky when you're looking into the future. We can read the words, we can read about 1290 and 1260 and times half a times 1335 and so on and so forth. What it means exactly, we're not always sure, but let's look at Luke 21 again, because one thing you and I must be doing, we can't spend our time, you know, analyzing prophecy to the nth degree, trying to understand the Greek and Hebrew backwards and forwards and so on, but we can, I think, respect God's word. One third of the Bible, at least, frankly, is prophecy. And all scripture, including all prophecies given by inspiration, is profitable for us. And it's important that we respect it and take some time to be familiar with it. But the main thing is that you and I must be always found to be living right and to be ready. Look at Luke 21, starting verse 34. This is red letters. And it's talking of the end time. This is the tail end of the Olivet prophecy. We've been here already in verse 20 about the armies surrounding Jerusalem. We've read verse 20 or verse 19 about by your patience you'll preserve your lives. What's Jesus' final comment? At the end of this warning of the days of vengeance upon Jerusalem, he says, verse 34, take heed. Take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come on you, disciples, unexpectedly. And that's a warning. That's a strong warning. Jesus is talking to Peter and James and John, and by extrapolation to you and me, because we're today's disciples of Jesus Christ, and he says, take heed. And it must apply more today because these are the end times. Take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and perhaps more commonly, cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. And you know what a snare is like? It's a sudden, it's unexpected, it's abrupt, and the animal didn't see the snare, otherwise he wouldn't have got into it, would he? The animal is walking down to the waterhole, doesn't see a snare there. It just takes him immediately by surprise. He's okay 1 minute, and a second later, bang, his leg is trapped, and he's a goner. And that's how it's going to happen to the whole earth, suddenly, dramatically, unexpectedly. And it shouldn't be that way to us. Verse 36, watch therefore. And it doesn't mean, you know, watch the news necessarily. It just means be alert. I think the New American Standard Bible says, keep on the alert. Watch therefore, and pray always, that you may be counted worthy to escape all those things that will come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. And really that's, I guess, the final comment on our study of the book of Daniel. The prophecies we've read, hopefully they give us a bit of a better grasp. They give us probably no more than outline of future events. We may have some of the details a little bit wrong, perhaps even a lot wrong. But the end time is upon us. Jesus Christ will soon return. The world will witness dramatic developments. The important thing for you and for me is that we do what Jesus said. We watch and pray always that we will be accounted worthy to escape all these things and to stand before Jesus Christ at his return.